things will be normalized so that the spins are not spins, but they're Pauli matrices. So I've renormalized the spins so that the coupling isn't SI dot SJ, but Pauli matrices. Now, from the cultural point of view, have all of you done the atomic physics where these things were motivated by Heisenberg? Or is this, or you don't have that culture? It's worth the culture. You know that in the early 1920s, that Hund did spectroscopy, atomic spectroscopy, and he found that the multiplicity of atoms in their ground state, when the atoms had high spin, that the multiplicity was maximum. And an extreme example is manganese. Manganese has five spins in the 3D shell, and its magnetization, as its spin is 5 halves. You can go from 5 halves and then 3 halves, 1 half. It can have all the spin eigenvalues of a 5-electron system. But it happens to have a maximum of multiplicity. It's 2s plus 1 degenerate, and you have, if you put a magnetic field on, you split the line into 5 parts and so on. So that's one's rule, that atoms in their ground state have maximum multiplicity. And so the first question is why. For example, an easier case is a carbon. A carbon has two 2p electrons. And these two, first of all, these two 2p electrons go into orthogonal orbitals, say px and py, okay? And within these orbitals, you put an electron in here, an electron in here. They both, you have a 2-electron system in good approximation. The a ground state then can be the symmetric or anti-symmetric linear combination of the two spin systems, alpha alpha plus alpha beta plus beta alpha plus beta beta, or alpha beta minus beta alpha, which has spin zero. So it can either be the triplet or the singlet, according to whether the spins are parallel, okay? And it's the triplet. Carbon ground state is a triplet, just like manganese ground state is a quintuplet. So why? Here's the next question. I've already partially explained why, because I said that the orbitals have to, that the space orbitals have to be on orthogonal directions. You wouldn't want to put the two electrons in the same space orbital, because if you put the two electrons in the same space orbital, the electrons would cover each other in a large part of the wave function, and then the electronic repulsion would be larger when the amount of covering of the orbitals is less. So they prefer to go into orthogonal a spatial wave function to minimize the energy. So that's half the answer. But why in these two orthogonal wave functions do they choose to be in a triplet and not the singlet? And the answer is very beautiful, and I think that's really Heisenberg right at the outset in the 1926-27. He said that, or the Dirac, one or the other, I've forgotten. The point is that if the spin wave function is symmetric, then the orbital wave function is anti-symmetric. So if I call this px of r1, py of r2, and the spin wave function is symmetric, that gets multiplied by px of r2 minus py of r1. But should I write it down, or? I don't want to. Now, it has the total wave function has to be either symmetric or anti-symmetric. So if it's symmetric with respect to the orbitals, it's anti-symmetric with the spins and vice versa. So let's try to make it anti-symmetric, because that's the answer. It's anti-symmetric. And that's what it likes. It's anti-symmetric because if R1 is equal to R2, the wave function is zero. So in the configuration where R1 is equal to R2, the wave functions don't cover each other. If it's symmetric, then the recovering is maximal in the region where the two electrons are near. So clearly, if you would work out the expectation value of the Coulomb energy between the two, but you want them maximally separated. So it chooses the anti-symmetric wave function. But if it chooses the anti-symmetric wave function, then it chooses the spin wave function to be symmetric. But that's your atomic physics. I mean, alpha alpha or alpha beta, you know. Okay? Any one of the three members of the triplet, that's degenerate. So you explain beautifully that carbon is a triplet, and manganese is a quintuplet, and so on. It's a sign of how education goes today. When I was a kid, and I learned quantum mechanics, and then very early on, and this was part of the course, because of that, we had to learn atomic spectra, we had to learn chemistry, and so on.
Excuse me? My first quantum course was from a chemist. This was very important to him.
Yeah.
Well, I learned it from a mathematician, so maybe that says something.
Now, if you want to be amused, to read the direct chapter in the principles of quantum mechanics. It's really good. So, then Heisenberg being Heisenberg at the same time that he was inventing the quantum mechanics and quantum field theory and everything else and the uncertainty principle and God knows what all, he played around with this practical stuff. And he suggested that a ferromagnet is precisely that, where the electrons on neighboring atoms wanted to be in a symmetric eigenstate, and therefore you had a coupling sigma I dot sigma j, and with a minus sign, the lowest eigenvalue is negative when you're in the triplet state. And he suggested that this is the model of the ferromagnet. Now, that's naive reasoning. And then always people struggled for the next 30 years to prove he was essentially right. But it was a lot of work to get it all straightened out as a many-body problem and so on. But in the end, that's the essence of it. So let's take the system seriously. And let's look at the ground states. And the ground state is degenerate. One candidate for the ground state is to put the system in an eigenstate of sigma iz total, siz total, equal to n over 2. That is, as you do quantum mechanics, you look for the total eigenfunction. The total spin is the sum of all the spins, and the highest eigenvalue is when you can get them all in parallel, and that's the highest value of Siz that you can get, and you'll find that H or whatever it is. That will be the ground state energy. And that's n-fold degenerate. Because S Z total is the total rotational generator along the z-axis of this n-spin system. So S Z minus total. So I have a representation. I have an irreducible representation with the highest weight. I don't know if you know group theory. Yeah? With the highest weight is n over 2. And then n over 2 minus 1, n over 2 minus 2, et cetera, but obtained by multiple commutation with the group generators in this representation. This representation is a representation spanned by these n spins. And there are many, many representations of this n spin system, but the highest one, the one you start with, is this one. And then after that, you build other representations which contain anti-symmetric combinations, but this is the one. And so then you have this state degenerate with this state, and then you do it twice and then three times, and then you discover that the ground state is a 2s plus 1 degenerate. That is a 2n. N plus 1 degenerate. N plus 1 degenerate. You see it. And you play with your fingers. It's all up. And then some linear combination of these and some linear combination of these and so on. And you discover the whole representation. So that's a description of the ground state. Now suppose you have an imaginary, a little bit, an infinitesimal magnetic field in the z direction on the system. So you break the degeneracy. And then when you have an H as z total, the Hamiltonian no longer commutes with the rotational generators because the H as z total does not commute with the transverse generators, with the SX total and the SY total. So you break the degeneracy with an HZ, and the lowest energy state of that non-degenerate set, and the most convenient one, is that one. So let's imagine a little imaginary infinitesimal magnetic field, and I begin with the spins, and let's make the computation of the excitation energy from that state. The lowest energy state is the one with all spins up. And now let's see if we can, beginning with that state, you get the excitation energy, and then turn off the external magnetic field, and get the spectrum of the low excited states. Let's give ourselves that exercise. And that exercise can be done. But that's an exact analytic exercise that you can solve to get the lowest energy excited states from beginning with that state. And that problem was solved by Felix Bloch in 1937, and he called the answer the theory of spin waves. And then Dyson in the 1950s took up Bloch's calculation, and he proved it was a rigorous calculation. I don't see how it could not be rigorous, but it was rigorous. And Dyson made an estimate of the first order corrections, which it's exact, but I don't think it's useful, so I won't go into that. It's not useful because by the time the corrections become important, but the whole picture breaks down. So I won't discuss that. So I'm going to look for for the simplest class of excited states, beginning with all spins up. So that's my ground state with an infinitesimal magnetic field. And then I'm going to turn. And now, if I didn't have the exchange potential, Vij, Six, Sjx, plus Y. If I didn't have that, then the lowest energy excited states would literally be simply one spin turned down. Because that would cost me an energy minus V0 plus V0, would cost me energy to 2V0, would cost me the magnetic field energy of the neighbors to flip it the wrong way. So that would be the excited state, that would be another excited state, and so on. And so I would have various spins down. So clearly it's a useful basis and a useful guess that the lowest energy excited states are composed of the sector with one spin down. Furthermore, that's interesting from the point of view of group theory, because from one spin down, you can make group theoretical representations. So it's a group theoretical sense that you build the reputation from, you begin with Sz is equal to n, and then you start to class the states with Sz is equal to n minus 1, and you build representations. And we want irreducible representations because we want these states to be the eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian commutes with total rotations. I've got to write that. That Hamiltonian up there is a scalar. Therefore, any excited state has to be an eigenfunction of the rotational generators. So try the trilinear combinations of one spin down. And let's look for the AIs that makes this an eigenvalue. So it's required excitation energy from, it's how much energy, how much more energy you have to put in to that state to make an excitation, which costs you an energy omega. So that's an eigen, and that's an eigenvalue problem. I'm going to call AI sigma I minus. I'm going to call that psi operator. So this is going to be, I'm going to focus on this operator, and I'm going to switch my language from looking at eigenstates to, if you like, eigenoperators. What operator I have to multiply on the ground state of Fock space to get an excited state. And I'm going to focus on the properties of psi up. And now I claim that H psi up is equal to omega. That is, instead of focusing on because this is equal to H psi up minus psi up H. So that guy is equal to the ground state energy, and that guy is the ground state energy plus the excitation energy, and the difference of them is the excitation energy. So the eigenvalue condition comes up as an operator condition, using H as an operator and psi as an operator, and you look for this this commutator operating on this ground state equal to a C number omega. That's the exercise. Do I need another giant? Where's the hockey stick? I think it's unwritten under. That's free. Yeah, thanks. I wonder what, and I should put a little label on here, I guess, to say I want the omega-th operator to obey this condition. Where psi up. And then I would put a, it looks like that. And now you just slug away and you do commutations. I did the commutation relation of it takes a lot of cold blood to keep track of factors of two. So the hardest part of this calculation is 2, the number 2. That's because I'm using sigmas and not s's. S, the commutator of si, sj is epsilon ij k sk. The commutator of sigma j is 2 times epsilon ij k sigma k. So the student or the teacher frets for a half hour until he gets all this, the factors of two correct, because that's a very hard job. And this two, by the way, is essential for the physics, to understand the physics, because this two will show up. Because I, as I said, if you just had the Ising model, and you had the all spins up, and you turn the spin, then the energy would be the energy of this spin when its neighbors are all up, minus the energy when its neighbors are down. So it's, so you go from the magnetic field H to minus minus H, such 2H. That too is reflected in this too, when you interpret the algebra. It's a very fundamental too. Sometimes two are unimportant in physics and sometimes they are. This happens to be a very important one. So you get two. You put the Hamiltonian in. Wait a second. No, I didn't get the right line. Here's the Hamiltonian. Now I've done the commutator, and I get sigma I minus sigma j z. So I've used nothing here but the commutator of the sigmas, which you know. And this guy operating on this guy is 1. And this guy operating on this guy is 1. And I have been very careful to respect that I have operators and I write everything in the order that's correct, because sometimes you have to be careful by getting the orders mixed. But the way I wrote it is correct. Put a little omega here. So now you do some algebra. No, I haven't yet done algebra. I've just rewritten it so that the sense emerges. Okay. In this form, one sees a sense. Namely, on the left-hand side, you have this linear combination. In this term, the encircled operators in this product are the same linear combination as the operators which occur on the left-hand side. So this factors out in this sum on J. So I have the same thing as on the left-hand side. So this is once more psi up, and then I have the J, the Vij times this that state, but the sum on Vij is what I call V of zero. It's the molecular field at t is equal to zero. So I interpret this term. Namely, if I did not have this term, a solution would be that AI would be anything, and the excitation energy would be 2 times the molecular field. It would be as if I had the Ising model. And that first term just is telling me that I get the excitation energy, it all spins up, and I turn any one down, and that will be an eigenfunction with the correct excitation energy, which is twice the molecular field at absolute zero. However, that is not the true eigenfunction, and that's the major discovery of Monsieur Félix Bloch. Because of the exchange energy, sigma I transverse, sigma j transverse, a spin sigma iz on that site, when it gets multiplied by sigma I minus sigma j plus, takes that spin down and turns its neighbor up. Should I say it again? Vij, sigma j plus sigma I minus operating on the sigma ith component of the ground state psi zero, takes that up spin, turns that one down, and puts its neighbor plus. So you have a sequence of a successive of flippings that's encoded in the eigenvalue equation. Just 2 I omega Vij sigma j minus. Thus, the component of the wave function that had the I spin flipped down, which gave the molecular field energy, now has added to it this what's called exchange term in the technical jargon, Ij, this is sum on Ij, in which the ith spin, instead of being represented as a down spin down, in this linear combination, it's a neighbor, which has been turned down because of the coupling. That's the role of the coupling, the transverse coupling. And why is a transverse coupling there? Transverse coupling there is because the Hamiltonian is a scalar. And if I just had sigma iz, sigma jz as the coupling, like in the Ising model, that would not be a rotational scalar. So this fundamental adjunction of the exchange is a reflection of the scalarity of the Hamiltonian. It's because of the necessity to add sigma ix, sigma jx, plus sigma iy, sigma jy, to the sigma iz, sigma jz term. By the way, if you look up the history of physics, this happens time and time and time again. The classical example is when quantum mechanics first came out. Then Einstein accounted for the deviation of the Dulong specific heat. Of the Dulong Petit specific heat, saying that the specific heat went exponential. So this goes all the way back to 1900. And he said that, look, each atom sits in the potential of its neighbors, and so it's in a well, and so it gets excited in the well. And so Einstein said that the specific heat dropped off like e to the minus beta omega, where omega would be the eigenfunction of the particle in the well. And then there was a clever man in Dubai, in Aachen, who said, even Einstein can sometimes make a little mistake, because the atoms which contribute to the well are in correspondence with their neighbors, and then when you write the complete coupled equations, and then you find that the right solution is a wave. And then he invited his friend von Karman to write a paper, I think it was in 1900, and they got the right answer, that the baddest waves exist. So that's, and as I say, this example happens time and time again in physics. You're tempted to say that the excitation energy is the molecular field energy, like Einstein, for the specific heat problem, but it's not. Because the neighbors which are responsible for the effective for the local potential, are in interaction with their neighbors. And you can't get away with it. Now, for the specific heat problem, I don't have time to go into it. That's also an example of spontaneous broken symmetry, where the spontaneous broken symmetry is the broken translational symmetry. Phonons of zero mass are a response to a spontaneous broken symmetry. So you can leave a little space and just prove that, help you prove the analogies. Well, you just diagonalize this. But that's very easy to diagonalize. Because in consequence of translational symmetry, V is a function of Ri minus Rj. So, obviously, the trick is to use the Fourier transform. What you find is a solution with AI omega proportional to e to the iq dot ri. You can verify that. And you find that omega is a function of the q that figures in there. You define a sigma q minus, which is called a spin wave. And you just substitute into there, and you get two. So you find that the Fourier transform of the sigma I minus, which is a wave, it's a sigma I minus as I go through the space of the crystal. It's a wave that looks like that, turning the spins down with successive amplitude with the weights given in terms of the inverse wavelength. The omega q is v0 minus v2. It looks like this, and it goes to zero here. This is q squared, and it goes up. And in particular, omega zero is equal to zero. But I didn't have to make a calculation to prove that omega zero is equal to zero, because if AI is one, if AI is one, then the eigenfunction, which is being proposed, is sigma zero minus, but sigma zero minus is sigma x total minus sigma y total minus I sigma y total. Is sigma at q is equal to zero minus is the transverse generator of the rotational group. But the transverse, but the total transverse generator of the rotational group commutes with the Hamiltonian. And therefore, the total, and therefore the Hamiltonian must be degenerate with respect to the uniform rotation. So I have discovered in the analysis, rediscovered, something which I knew before, namely the degeneracy of the eigenstate. But in addition to that, what I have discovered is that that point, omega equals zero, q equal to zero, which is a kinematical point, is the terminus of a dynamical spectrum, which is the spin wave spectrum. So that's the result of the analysis. So the spontaneous broken symmetry comes up in the statement, yes, there is a zero mass mode, and the zero mass mode must be interpreted as an excitation whose terminal point at infinite wavelength is the generator of the group of symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And that's the interest of the exercise. And then from there, you can study what happens at finite temperature, and you can find that there, that it's a good approximation in the partition function, that at low temperatures you build up a bosine, that the sigma q minus and good approximation commutes with the sigma q prime minus, and so you can build up a Bose-Einstein gas and build up a temperature dependence of how the magnetization will decrease in temperature. But that's not of interest in this course. Of interest in this course is the conceptual content of the various manifestations of spontaneous broken symmetry that you run into. And this, I think, is one of the important exercises in that conceptual content. Now, should I go into a Bose-Einstein conversation? Or are you tired? What I can do is I can give you the ideal Bose-Einstein gas as a review, and then next time if we start the fireworks, because there are non-trivial things. I begin with the trivial things with the ideal Bose-Einstein gas, and then and next time we'll present Anzager's splendid calculation to show that even when the atoms and the gas interact, there is still a condensation in a very beautiful formula. And then we'll go into the Bugge-Yubov calculation of the spectrum. And that will take us halfway through the course. And then we do superconductivity for a day or two, and then we do a gauge theory. So the course is advancing. Ideal gas. I begin with NK. For simplicity of notation, you keep your wits more about you if you write it this way. That's standard Bose-Einstein statistics. At N of k is always greater than zero. Therefore, at k is equal to zero, epsilon of k is zero. Therefore, N of zero is greater than or equal to zero. Therefore, C must be greater than 1, greater than or equal to 1. The populations have to be numbers, have to be natural numbers. And then, what is the interest of the problem? The interest of the problem is that when the temperature goes down, then the Compton wavelength, the momentum goes down, and then the mean Compton wavelength of the particles grows. And if you lower the temperature enough, then the mean Compton wavelength becomes comparable with the distance between the particles, with the mean distance between the particles. And so then the particle wave functions overlap. And therefore, classical thinking fails. So the most primitive way to display this interesting physical phenomenon is to begin with the ideal gas, and then after that, to throw in the interactions. So that's how we begin, and that's the interest of this very easy computation, which is why I'll end with it, because it always makes one feel better to do something easy. So N. So from this you get that rho, N over V, is equal to rho. Going into dimensionless variables. Where lambda is equal to 1 on square root of mt. So lambda is a length which involves 1 over the square root, which involves 1 over, this is an energy and this is an energy, so this is 1 over an energy, so lambda is a length. So the so there's a dimensionless parameter called r. in which the physics changes radically according to whether R is big or small. If the temperature is high, if T is very large, then lambda goes to zero. Is that? Yeah. If T is large, the momentum becomes high, yeah, and lambda goes to zero, then this is small. If this is small, then C must be very large. If the C is very large, so for high T, R is equal to a constant times. C e to the minus x squared over 2. So that's some number. So C, at high temperature, C and R are the same thing. And I see everybody's going to sleep, so I better stop before I condense the particles. I think you've had enough. So next time we'll condense them and we'll make T small.